This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 311 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas. I guess it's a little bit early, but we're not recording next week. And Happy New Year. And tonight we're recording a little bit earlier than normal because tonight is Star Wars. So I'm kind of overly excited and kind of hyper tonight.
I was going to say, this is probably the second most exciting thing you're doing this evening.
No. UAV Digest is always the most exciting thing that I do every Thursday night.
Hey, all right.
Second only to maybe Star Wars, but that only comes out every 3 years or whatever. So, but we got some great stories, Max. We've got a tilt rotor drone, a fishing drone, a single seat Vertol electric drone, expanding the availability of U.S. designated and manufactured drones, and drones for Menlo Park. I don't know that last story. I missed that one. But Menlo Park, okay, that sounds good. So should we get started?
Yeah, let's get started, David.
Well, our first story comes from CNET.com, and VCopter Falcon 4K camera drone gets 50-minute flight time with just two rotors. So I know that you posted to our Slack team what we should call a two-rotor. You know, we're so used to using quadcopters and octocopters and hexacopters. So is it a bicopter? What are we talking about, Max?
Well, that's what they're calling it here. Falcon is calling it a bicopter. In my Greek reference, it could be a dicopter, too, I believe. But Falcon's calling it a bicopter. It comes from, well, Falcon is the name of the bicopter. It comes from 00 Robotics, and they're calling this the V-copter, copter spelled C-O-P-T-R.
And it's got two rotors that tilt, though we're not sure they got drop a full 90 degrees, but it's like my office where I go out and look at the V-22. So, and it's slower rotating propellers are quieter than a normal, say, quadcopter or a hexacopter, and you get both the advantage of horizontal flight and vertical flight.
It's also got a three-axis mechanical gimbal for the video camera, which is 4K. It also takes 12 megapixel stills, which is pretty good. And the controller has a flip-up mount for your phone.
What's really nice is it's got auto follow with obstacle avoidance. It will follow you if you want to go skiing or water skiing or whatever. And it detects objects and avoids collisions. Hopefully, if it's tracking you, you're also avoiding collisions.
Yes. Pre-programmed flight paths, 7 kilometer transmission distance, and it weighs 730 grams. Now, this is available only for pre-order now, but it is an interesting device, a little drone here. It's, I think, focused on aerial photography. Sorry for that. They expect to start shipping this in February, but it's definitely got a different look to it with only two rotors. There is a limited time offer, a pre-order offer. You get a pretty significant discount. You do have to put down a $100 deposit for it with a balance of $599 due when it ships. And it looks like that deal is good through the end of this year, through December 31st, 2019. But I like the idea that it's quieter, although I'd like to see some data on that. And I also kind of like the idea that it really is a different looking drone than your usual quadcopter.
You know, folks, I love the fact that he said he'd like to see the data on whether it's quieter or not. Wouldn't you like to hear whether it's quieter or not?
Yeah, but show me the numbers.
You know, this just shows you the kind of person he's become after all these years of podcasting. He doesn't listen to anything anymore. He just looks at the whole universe as sine waves.
Oh, I guess.
But yeah, I agree. It's kind of a neat sort of different shape, different feel to it. So maybe hopefully in February when it comes out and it starts shipping, there will be people giving some reviews. I'll be interested to see what's going to come of this.
Yeah, for sure.
And competitor to other major organizations. Well, our second story comes from commercialdroneprofessional.com, and it's about fishing drones and waterproof. I thought this was kind of bizarre. This is not something we've talked about, you know, in all of our environmental stuff from Heather. We've talked about finding fish and tracking whales, but we've never talked about actual fishing.
This comes from a company called Gannett, and they're really, really into drone fishing. In fact, that's their website, dronefishing.com. And they make bait release systems for most drones. But recently they've gone farther and they crowdfunded the development of the Gannett Pro quadcopter. It's fully waterproof and sandproof. It can release 3.5 kilogram payloads of bait hundreds of meters away. The controller is GPS enabled, and it uses a barometric pressure control system to adjust flight altitude. Now, have you looked into this barometric pressure control system, David? It's an interesting alternative to what most waterproof flying drones use.
I hadn't seen much in the line of waterproof flying drones. It just sort of struck me as kind of odd that we've gone into waterproof drones. The other part that was sort of odd was dropping bait hundreds of meters away. I don't know why you would be deploying, if you're trying to fish, why you're deploying bait hundreds of meters away, or that's one really long fly line. But tell us a little bit more, because you're the engineer of the organization, about this barometric pressure.
Well, if you've got a waterproof drone, of course, you need a way to, as with any drone, to measure the altitude. And just about every other waterproof drone uses a membrane. And the membrane, it has to breathe. And the drone has to replace roughly as much as 20%, they say, of their internal air volume during each flight. Now, as the electronics in the drone and the battery heats up during use, that internal air volume expands, and that excess volume needs to be relieved, and it's pushed out through the membrane, the drone's sealed shell. And these membranes are breathable. It can be cloth or paper-like kind of a membrane. But when things cool down, the membrane draws in moist air, and so that's introducing moisture to the inside of the drone. And that, of course, is not good long-term for the electronics. So what we have in this drone is, instead of this breathable membrane or mesh, the Gannett Pro uses a flexible internal flight bladder. So it works kind of on the same principle as the swim bladder of a fish. So Gannett says this technology, this relatively simple technology, but different than other waterproof drones, has that advantage of not sucking back in moist air as the internal volume expands and contracts. It's pretty interesting. And they have a video, and we'll put this in the show notes, that it's a promotional video, but it really gives you a good idea just about how robust these waterproof drones are. And they show it, you know, in a beach kind of a scenario, ocean kind of a scenario. And this drone is unaffected by being tossed into the water, taking off out of the water, encountering waves as it's flying. It really does, at least as portrayed in the video, look like it's pretty impervious to water, and it handles the wind that you would normally associate with, you know, a beachfront or, you know, ocean kind of conditions. So it's kind of well-suited to being used in that kind of an environment, either for fishing or to deploy, you know, life-saving devices to swimmers in difficulty, things like that.
I love it when he gets excited over things. He was almost as excited over that, folks, as he is about fuel cells, but not quite.
Well, that's because it's different, you know, and it's specialized to a unique application. But Gannett has, they have a pretty wide range of drone fishing products. So if you're at all interested in that, you need to check out Gannett. But as I mentioned, they have bait release systems for DJI drones, the Phantom, the Mavic, and the Inspire. They have some generic release systems for other drones that this could be fitted to. They sell drone fishing rods. I'm not sure what constitutes a drone fishing rod, but they sell that too. So the Gannett Pro and the Pro Plus, they're available for pre-order, like the other drone we were talking about, at a discount. They expect to start shipping these in January 2020. So check that out if you're interested, and see our website for a look at the video of the Gannett Pro waterproof drones.
Now comes the one that I want for Christmas. Dear Santa, and this is from evirtual.com. Silverwing reveals full-scale S1 prototype. Hey, it's finally my single-seat flying motorcycle / hover car, and it's electric. I like it. I want it to commute every day. The S1 is a single-seat vertical takeoff and landing electric drone developed by the team at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. And it's Dutch.
It's Dutch.
Yeah. Let's hear it for the ancestors putting it out there.
There you go.
So what do you think, Max? Would you want to strap on this S1 drone?
I think it would be, yes, it looks like a lot of fun. It takes off and lands vertically, of course, since it's VTOL, on its tail, and then it tilts forward for horizontal flight. It's got two large enclosed propellers. I'm not sure what the power plant is that it's electric, right? So they're electric motors.
Bunch of batteries or fuel cells.
Yeah.
You know, this is your expertise. Yeah.
Now, this S1 was designed to meet the requirements of the GoFly competition. So it's one of the competitors. The GoFly prize is sponsored by Boeing. It's for innovators, inventors, engineers, makers to design and build a personal flying device. Now, the final fly-off is at Moffett Federal Airfield at NASA's Ames Research Center in California, and that's with support by Boeing, but also Google's Planetary Ventures and Pratt & Whitney, and that runs from Thursday, February 27th through Saturday, February 29th, 2020, of course. And the first couple of days, the 27th and the 28th, are invitation-only days. The teams will be there flying their entries in this competition. There's going to be keynote panels by industry and government leaders. AUVSI is going to be there, or plans to. Also AOPA, Gamma, Pratt & Whitney, Embraer, Boeing. So that sounds pretty exciting, but that part of it's by invitation. But on Saturday the 29th, the GoFly events will be open to the public, and that will feature an air show that includes the GoFly teams flying and showcasing their personal flyers. So, David, if you could get out there for this, you could at least see it. The California Air National Guard will perform a pararescue jump. There'll be speakers, team interactions, a celebration of aviation. So it's on the West Coast. It's in California, which is kind of far away from where we sit, David. But gosh, if you're in that part of the country in late February, the 29th, I think that would be a must-attend kind of event.
I think we need to get our correspondent at large to stop flying for a weekend and drive down, Mr. Trescott, or if you're listening. I think this is actually kind of cool. The S1's capable of flying 37 miles, and it just happens to be that my commute from my apartment to the museum is 31 miles. So I've actually got some additional length to go there. So I'm looking for it, and it can charge all day, and I can fly back home. It would save me on the hour and a half commute that I had the other night.
Yeah, the museum would probably let you plug it in, right?
Sure. And it's a rotorcraft. It would fit right in.
Perfect.
I can display it at the museum.
There you go.
But Silverwing earlier was one of five winners in the Phase 2 competition, taking home $50,000 to develop. Now, the final thing will be Boeing will be sponsoring a $1 million grand prize. I guess that will be issued on the 29th, which is Leap Day, at that event. So if you get in the area of Northern California, you should check this out. And I guess, Max, we should probably do some research on who the other four competitors are for this competition, because I think we should follow up on that just to check. And we'll have a link in the show notes that you can request an invitation to go to the professional days. So if you have an interest, check out our website. Domestic drone options. Now, we've talked about the federal government here in the United States does not want people to use foreign products because of security risks. And this was from nextgov.com. The U.S. Department of Defense wants to see a U.S. ecosystem for small UASs and counter technologies. I guess they don't want us to be using DJI anymore, huh?
And they want to have, like you say, an ecosystem here in the United States where the products are not only domestically created, but also funded. And they want to make this, they being the Department of Defense, wants to make this a priority in 2020. And there's some comments from the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, Ellen Lord, that kind of capture what they're after. She says, quote, "We see this as developing an ecosystem to have investment in areas that the Department of Defense thinks are particularly critical for providing capabilities to the warfighter, but also translate many times into commercial products." And she says, and I think you know that DJI flooded the market with low-cost quadcopters, particularly, which eroded our industrial base and really altered the landscape for the U.S. government and for the small drone industry. What we want to do is reinvigorate that. So they're trying to address that issue. And the government wants to have the ability to, you know, utilize these kinds of devices, these kinds of aircraft. And so they're trying to encourage a domestic capability that we don't really have right now.
And so the DOD partnered with Texas A&M University for a drone venture day. They showcase national security-related work from 39 U.S. UAS and counter UAS manufacturers and 12 trusted capital providers. The capital providers came from what Lord called a clean money, small businesses that started with the U.S. government funds at university or labs. They're looking to revigorate the homegrown UAS industry by pumping U.S. capital into it instead of sending it overseas. It's interesting. I'm curious, what's the next step? We have tariffs on drones coming in the country from overseas like China or other countries. So the Department of Defense, of course, is viewing this as a security risk. But Lord also continued to say, "My goal is to make sure we have 3 to 5 systems that are tailored to a series of different types of threats and that we can get the economy of scale, having a few best systems out there." Now, we talked about how to get those systems to the warfighters' hands as quickly as possible, along, very importantly, with training and a logistics tail. So it's not only just building the hardware, but it's building the software, and they're investing in the infrastructure for a long term. So
we will be watching to see what the Department of Defense does in addition to this one example, the Drone Venture Day, and looking to see what they do next year in 2020 to help support and develop a U.S., a domestic U.S. drone industry. Very interesting. I think it could go different ways. It could be handled in different ways. I think a lot of people would be happy if the worldwide drone production was a little bit less concentrated in one particular country.
Was that one particular country or one particular company? I didn't know which one you said.
Yes.
One particular company located in one particular country. Mm. Max, in your experience over time in your former life, did you ever see anything like this in the engine industry where the Department of Defense or somebody else stepped back to reinvigorate an infrastructure?
Not to this extent. I think I've seen in the past examples where the federal government has supported a particular company or several companies in order to ensure that there's competition, that the competitors, the domestic competitors, remain healthy from a business standpoint. But this seems to be a much larger task because we're starting from, you know, a baseline of relatively little impact in the overall industry, the overall drone industry, you know, like 5 or 10%, something like that, with DJI having the other 90 or 95%. So I think it's a much bigger task here.
Okay, I had to figure out where Menlo Park was. You know, that's one of those names that shows up and you don't remember where it is. But Menlo Park is in California. And this was AlmanacNews.com. Menlo Park proposal for city drone program raises civil liberty questions. Well, you know, every time we get these towns and cities interfering with drone operations, it always comes up to civil liberties. You know, there are rules already built for that. So, Max, what's going on here?
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting case study in some ways. Either, you know, local communities or governments that are looking at bringing drones in to perform some variety of functions, or those who want to approach a city or a town, a regional government with opportunities to employ drones to do certain things, could kind of learn from this a little bit, I think. So the Public Works Department, the police, community development leaders approached a Menlo Park City Council study session, and they made the case for Menlo Park using drones. And it's all the things that we've talked about on this podcast, and I think that, you know, all of our listeners would be familiar with: using drones for facilities inspections and roof inspections and inspections in confined spaces that are too small for people. Other examples they use: checking parks to see that contractors completed the assigned work, and inspecting trees to monitor health under bridges, inspections of unsafe structures, like, for example, after a home is damaged by a fallen tree. But they also talked about law enforcement applications at crime scenes and at traffic accidents, and also things such as finding missing people. So they're all the good uses for drones in a town or in a city. And the council was open to the idea of using drones, but I think the instructive part of this is the concerns that they had about privacy and civil rights. The Menlo Park Council was basically saying, yeah, these are all great ideas, but what about capturing people on video who are not involved in whatever the scene is that's being covered by a drone? Things like, should the public be notified when drones are being used? And what about if somebody calls the police department and says a suspicious person has been seen, and they send a drone out, and maybe that person is only suspicious to the caller because of the color of their skin or the way they're dressed, something like that? And maybe there should even be penalties for abusive use of drones. So they raised all of these concerns, And the mayor, Ray Mueller, said, "For me, the use cases are great. I just want to have a discussion about what the guardrails are." And he asked that the city staff come back to them, bring along a drone program expert, and also come back with clearer, more specific policies on acceptable use of the drones, as well as things like the software applications that would be used. And also he was looking to, the mayor was looking to see more detail about how many man hours of work, let's say, would be reduced if drones were employed to, you know, perform those functions.
The infamous CBA. One of the things that, Max, you had listed that I sort of found interesting, and they mentioned it in the article, was check parks to see contractors completed their assigned work. I thought that was a new one. It was a legitimate spying on our subcontractors, you know. But if you as the township are going out to do that, to check a work, and the example they gave was at a park, you do get into the, okay, what about all of the people that are in the park at the time that you're doing the inspection of? And a park made me think of young people and children, you know, and when we have events at the museum, we have to post, you know, legally, we post signs that say, we will be taking pictures, you know, or if we take a picture of a specific child or a person, individual, we have them sign a waiver so that they know that you had the picture taken and we can use it. In this case, if you're trying to inspect the whole in checking up to see if the contractors, there's sort of a impromptu notice of that idea, you know, if you're checking to inspect the contractor, you might want to do it on a random basis and not want to advertise that you're going to be surveying them with a drone, spying on them. But then, of course, you need to notify everybody else who you're filming at the time. So it's an interesting fine line, that one. I don't think we've actually thought about the civilian use of drones to monitor the work of others, you know, that kind of thing. So it's always been a result kind of thing. So this was an interesting concept to come out of this study.
Right. And if you're using drones in an application like this for public use, I mean, the video, I think, is available to the public. In other words, if a government entity is using these, then I think the video has to be available to the public, at least upon request. So, I mean, let's say that you've kind of worked out the legal aspects, let's say, of using a drone to check up on the work that a contractor has performed. But in that process, you've also captured images of people at the park. And if that's publicly available, a situation where, you know, hey, that's my husband, but that woman on the blanket that he's sitting next to is not me, you know, you're going to have some problems. So, interesting challenges, I guess.
But again, they are privacy challenges. But this is one of those challenges that, you know, we've always talked about privacy and, like, you don't need privacy loans specifically for drones because there are privacy laws already. But in this case, this one has got to be a drone-specific privacy, you know, data management thing. So it may be the exception to the rule that says, you know, the difference between a drone spying on your neighbor is no different than someone running a pair of binoculars spying on your neighbor. But in this case, it's an application where there are unintended consequences, or there could be serious unintended consequences.
So if you're in any way involved with public use of drones or drones used by public entities, governments, and so forth, take a look at this. I think there could be some knowledge sharing here that might be useful. But David, before we go, one more item, and I just saw this. We have a notice from the FAA to improve airman certificate testing. And we'll have a link in the show notes, of course, to the FAA item. But on January 13th, 2020, the FAA is going to make some, they call them, improvements to the way it tests applicants for an FAA Airman Certificate. Now, this applies to certified pilots for both manned and unmanned aircraft. So this impacts, you know, Part 107. And the FAA says that one of the most important changes is the requirement that applicants obtain an FAA tracking number, or FTN, by creating a profile in the Integrated Airman Certification and Rating Application. And you have to do that prior to registering for the knowledge test. So this rating system is a web-based application, and it guides you through the FAA Airman application process. They say it's a five-minute process, and it's a new requirement. Apparently, it's something that you have to do starting with January 13th, 2020. So we'll have that link in the show notes, and be sure to take a look at that if you are planning on applying for the knowledge test for either manned or unmanned aircraft.
And IACRA is a system that most manned pilots have been using for years. Yeah. So it's not something that would be foreign to them. It's just updating your profile. And if you're in the unmanned space and you have a 107, you need to go in IACRA and update your profile. It really isn't that hard. And I guess it's just streamlining the process and giving the FAA more data points that they can work with going forward. And it's no different than if your state changed your driver's license information or something additional required, like Real ID. This year, I had to update my driver's license for my Real ID. It won't be very painful. We'll follow up, but it shows that the FAA is still considering making the process the same for both, whether you're flying unmanned aircraft or manned aircraft.
All right. Well, with that, we want to thank you for listening to episode 311 of the UAV Digest. Find us at theuavdigest.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes, they're at theuavdigest.com/311.
And of course, we'd love for you to become part of our Slack listener team. And so you can talk about these topics going further. You can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can find us on Twitter @UAV Digest. You can find us on Facebook @facebook.com/UAV Digest. Most of all, you can have yourself a Merry Christmas or a Happy Hanukkah or a Happy New Year. Max and I guess we'll talk to you in 2020. It's hard to believe that, huh, Max?
Yes, it is.
So with that, I'm going to say we'll see you next year. This is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.